Welcome to Mind Rolling, and I'm Raghu Marcus.
And I'm Dave Silver.
And we have our research team has come up with some very interesting tidbits for. We have a big research team, and it's they all hang out at Dave's house and feed him information. So what did the research team come up with this week, Dave?
Well, the team, which is comprised of me and some wandering spirits, researchers. I mean, spirits, they don't have bodies. I just thought we should talk about the military-industrial complex. It's such a charming, cheerful, joyful, and, you know, uplifting subject.
I vote we don't.
Okay, so we're not going to talk about that. We're just not going to talk about it. But I know some interesting stuff about it, which I'll slip in somewhere. We're going to talk about politics, though. And one of the things we were sort of struck by, if you listen to this podcast in the next few weeks or months, or it'll be pretty topical, maybe in 25 years when you're still listening to them, it may seem kind of dated. But Mark Samford, let's get straight to it. Was the politician who was in a scandal just last year, I think. It was just a year ago, when he's from South Carolina, when he lied, and he disappeared for 4 days or something and said that he was on a hiking trip, but he'd actually gone to Venezuela to be with a woman he was in love with and was having an affair with. It was a real big scandal. However, he was just reelected, and quite easily in South Carolina. And, you know, it's very easy to sort of sneer about something like that and turn your nose up and go, oh, my God, people are crazy. But so that's one thing. He got reelected. Mm-hmm. So even a so-called conservative base still forgave him for that, and he got reelected. Then, about a week ago...
I'd like to know how that happened, actually.
Well, you live much closer to South Carolina than I do. But I don't know why. He just won quite easily. He won against... someone who didn't he win against Colbert's relative?
I don't know that. Maybe someone out there will let us know that, but I'll
look it up and we'll talk about it later. I'm sorry we don't know that. But anyway, the more amazing thing, which we can keel this whole thing off for a while, is that about a week or two ago Mark Samford mentioned that he'd become a meditator and had been following a Buddhist path and teachings. And I read a small interview on Huffington with him when he said something to the effect that the meditation had brought him to the present, brings him into the present moment, and gives him perspective.
Where did he go to even find out about it, or do you have any idea?
No, I don't, but I think it was some South Carolina Buddhist group.
Oh, really?
It wasn't like he went to, you know, India or Nepal or something. Anyway, when I read it, you know, it's so easy to sort of become kind of very cynical and skeptical. I was thinking, wow, you know, is he? But what, that's got no constituency. It's not like he's after the Buddhist vote. Clearly, he
South had Carolina.
Right, there's 11 people. But, you know, he made this statement, and it just struck me as another one of those moments when, as an individual, I had to sort of think, am I open-hearted about this person, or do I just, you know, think he's a creep? Because A, he's a right-wing Republican, and B, he lied to the country and his wife, etc. Mm-hmm. Or be open-hearted and go, you know, he's a child of God. I hate to sort of use those words, sound kind of drippy, but the truth is he is a child of God and has a right to expression. So, Raghu, what do you think? Do you think
Step back here a minute. What if he... I mean, so he eventually, of course, he admitted his sins and he came out with the truth. I wonder if his wife is still with him. No, I think he got together with this woman,
he's
right?
He married
that woman.
He's either married her or is about to, and his wife is extremely hostile to him. And he had the gall, actually, to ask her to manage his campaign, and she refused very publicly. And has been extremely, you know, sort of not friendly towards him.
Right. All right. Well, but he came out and he told the truth and he confessed and he, you know, most of the politicians, especially in this area, meaning I'm in North Carolina and in the South in general, would probably have become born-again Christians, right? That makes way more sense. You're going to get reformed, and now you're going to be, you're going to adhere to your religion and on a day-to-day basis, and his constituency would support that. I mean, that would seem to me to be the way that anybody from this area as a politician would go with it. So that alone maybe indicates that there is some kind of substantial sincerity there. I mean, possibly.
I think there is. And I only think that. I don't know him at all. But just because there's no great advantage to his base to make a statement like that. It doesn't help the so-called forgiveness process, and he doesn't even need that anymore because he's now back in Congress. He was the governor. Now he's in Congress. I'm just intrigued by it because of the basic sort of duality of right-wing, mean-spirited politics and Buddhism, which is entirely about compassion. It's not just about meditation, let's face it.
Yeah. I had a thought, but based on this whole conversation, actually, to let everybody know, came up. Dave and I were in a meeting yesterday, conference, and we've been working on a program that we would like to see go forward because we think it'll be a positive offering out there, and it's about just getting different, unique people together and having them talking about their own experiences, but they, coming from completely opposite worlds. And it's our byword is where worlds collide. And the idea is to just give some kind of revealing of from people who are in disparate situations to get to some commonality. And that's just a general part of our mission statement. Anyhow, we were going through this yesterday, and David brought up this guy, Sanford, as an example of someone. Wouldn't it be interesting to talk to this guy or get two people like him? And I think David said, like, Roshi Joan Halifax is a great
abbot. Oh, never mind that. Wouldn't it be interesting to get him to talk on this podcast? Because let's talk about the podcast for a minute. I think that what we talk about here is a lot about this, and it's because this is so many. It's a complex thing. It's not, love is simple and consciousness is actually simple, but when you get into samsara and the world and what's going on, you can't help but wonder about some stuff, and it seems kind of confusing. Because I would have thought that a Mark Sanford would be kind of hostile to Buddhism, because many, sort of Latter Day Christians that I've met. I don't mean Mormons. I just mean Christians of the last 50 years. Talk about Eastern religions involving devotion and also meditation as being black magic, for God's sake.
Yeah, and idols.
It's been said to me many times. It doesn't exactly please me when I hear it. But the thing is it possible that there are those people within it who can incorporate both easily and don't feel any conflict? He may be one of those. But on the other hand, Raghu, he's a politician. So you've got to wonder, why would he engage himself in what seemed to be not very helpful policies for people, and still consider himself some kind of
especially where he is. There's this other guy. Where's he from? Remember, I got...
Tim Ryan?
Tim Ryan, right. Tim Ryan.
Well, Tim Ryan, yeah. He's
a major Democrat. Mindfulness guy. Is he a Republican or a Democrat?
No. He's a liberal Democrat.
He's a liberal Democrat.
And he's from somewhere in the Midwest. Ohio,
right. So that all... It makes a lot more sense coming from where he's coming from, et cetera,
than
this guy Sanford.
When I went to see Tim Ryan, it was a Deepak Chopra's place. He calls it that, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
ABC building in downtown New York. Mm. And I went, and the conversation between Deepak and Representative Congressman Ryan was really, really encouraging. One couldn't even imagine being cynical about it, because Ryan was so clearly, wanted to progress in his practice of mindfulness and use it in the best way he could to influence other congressmen to have more compassionate ways of voting.
Right.
Well, it was, he was great. I really liked him.
Well, this is the crux of it, as far as I'm concerned, and something I would absolutely, yes, I would, if we could get him on this podcast, we should try and do that. or on this TV show that we've been talking about doing. But
well, on our vast budget here, we could fly him in on one of those, you know, sort of special.
Which brings something else up, but we won't talk about that right now, which is
Amazon.
Yeah.
Amazon. Audible. Ways to help us continue doing this. I'm going to intro. This is a harsh commercial. Amazon, buy your things through Amazon from the banner on our website, mindrollingpodcast.com, Amazon banner, Audible banner. If you want to buy anything from either of those two, it doesn't cost you anything. Just do it through those, and we get a percentage, and it helps us do this. That's
or
it.
Get a T-shirt or a mug. All right, so that's good. That's about maybe a 30-seconder. I like that, Dave. We should do more of those, but I want to go back to Sanford.
Sorry, I had to do it.
I want to go back to Sanford because to me, the interesting thing there is, and you know, and I would love to be able to ask him this, how do you reconcile these Buddhist inclinations? Let's just call it that, you know, and how do you reconcile that where compassion is a central tenet of this, of Buddhism with some of the stands that you represent as a conservative Republican regarding, obviously, in so many different areas, from healthcare to economic situations for people, how can you possibly validate if you have this I don't know how far he is into it. Maybe it is just there's some basic concepts that he agrees with that I don't even know how they.
It might be, you know, it might be like on that TV show Veep, you know, when people run up to, you know, Louis Dreyfus, the Veep, and give her an idea quickly. You know, this will work. Use it in that speech.
Right.
So maybe somebody said to him kind of trivially or whatever, you know, I've been going to this Buddhist class. It really relaxes me, Governor, Congressman. I think it could help you relax, really, because you're so busy now and the TV and the scandal. So this will help you relax. And he goes, yeah. And he goes and does that. And it does. But when he said the little statement he made about, I like the way it's brought me to the present moment, that's not an exact thing. Made me feel that he'd gone a little further than just how to feel better.
He's going to start teaching about be here now, and he's going to advance Ram Dass's teachings.
Perhaps. But your point is well taken, though. I mean, like, can a Republican, right-wing Republican, you know, and we all know what we feel about that in this room, or these two rooms, you know, who votes against the ability to help people who need help, and against various forms, and also is within a warmongering system, blah, blah, blah. How can someone like that, you know, be so-called spiritual? Or are we closed? Are they just making economic sense on some level? And then another department in their mind
is
totally...
But the thing is, he's not pandering, though. Who's he pandering to?
There's
no Buddhists in South Carolina. There's like one monastery or something.
Let's get
filled
him on
with
my,
six, you know, white people.
Roger, let's get him on this podcast. I bet we can, because we'll just tell him we're not going to do any kind of hateful or anti. Well, you're not. you're not.
Well, and we're two foreigners living in the United States.
Don't go there. He doesn't know that. My
I am not. I am now. You're a foreigner, basically.
I'm not. I'm a New Yorker, which I'm proud of. Bloomberg, Donald Trump. Okay, so. You know, seriously, it is an issue. Remember that guy? Oh, I've forgotten his name. He was the governor of Illinois or something. He was his name begins with K, and he was the governor. He was a senator or something, a congressman, and now Kasich, John Kasich.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so he's now Governor John Kasich, and he's one of those Midwestern governors who's voting against workers' rights completely. They're all doing it. You know, all those guys in those states who are kind of like worker states have like restricted union, you know, negotiations. Very, very right wing. Well, Kasich was known originally when he was first coming on TV like 15 years ago for being this huge deadhead, you know. Mm. And he talked about the Grateful Dead all the time. And when he was interviewed on talk shows, it was like always, so you're still listening to the Dead, you know. And every time it happened, I was wondering, there's something in me that just balks at it. It's very unfair. You know, I know Republicans who like Springsteen a lot. So is there something... Music's a bit different because you don't have to listen to the words. But if anybody listens to Bruce big time, they're going to get a huge percentage of social criticism and extreme liberal progressive ideas. Sorry, but it's true of Bruce Springsteen's work. I mean, he's not really political all the time, but when he is, you know where he stands. Yeah. So how do these right-wing governors in New Jersey and guys, you know, like, say they love Bruce? I guess if they said they didn't, they wouldn't get elected.
You know, it brings up just something that is so blatant in all of us. The level of judging that we do about all things.
Yes.
And of course, here is something where, because Sanford's the best example right now, just because where he lives, where he comes from, he can't be pandering on this thing.
No.
He, pandering would be born again. And, you know, it is such, it is so complex. We are so complex, each one of us. There's so many different motivations going on. He may sincerely believe in Buddhist compassion, and yet in his political life, it's just misfounded, related to the fact that he stands for in the way of the passage of bills that would, you know, that the obviously the Democrats and the liberal Democrats are trying to put through to support poor people, sick people, etc., and elderly. So, and we just can easily go, I don't give a shit what he's done. He likes Buddhism. Look what he's doing. You know, look what, you know, the action speaks, not what he personally believes. So it's easy to put him right down. And it's easy. The polarization is so natural in these instances, especially in politics, obviously, you know, that there is no room to consider him to be anything more than what we just project around his supposedly newfound religion or
He could also change, you see. I mean, okay, he's entered some teachings of Buddhism in some way. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt on that, because I believe him. And then as he gets more into it, it's possible that he will see, aspects of his own so-called policies that are just not compassionate and mm-hmm. will, in fact, change.
That's,
I mean, that happens.
Possible.
I would rather have a really nice conversation. I mean, I've spent a lot of my time working in various southern states and places where there were born-again Christians and everything. And I very rarely found any that were anything but very gentle and nice to me personally, you know. And at the same time, I would wonder what they would do, you know, to help poor people in Detroit or in Newark, you know. So in a sense, are you all right?
Yeah, okay. Sorry. Okay.
No. So there's a bifurcation there. There's kind of a compartmentalism and it's hard for me to take. Because I automatically think that liberal progressive views are towards humanitarianism and the betterment of most people on the planet rather than just an elite. And so it's very hard for me to like John Kasich or Mark Sanford, because I disagree with, as you just said, their mm-hmm. actions are what they do as politicians, not if they sit in a zendo or in a yoga room. Maybe that'll make them better, but they still are, shall we say, self-interest is much more important than...
Well, you know what? We should follow along his career here as he's newly elected. We should keep an eye on it. And wouldn't it be interesting to see if he did change his pattern of voting for this, that, or the other? Unlikely, given his constituency. Now, listen, what did you tell me about an interesting thing our friend Danny Goldberg mentioned to you about New Republicans? What was that? I thought that was really a little bit cynical, but...
Well, no, at one point, there were people like Joe Scarborough, who hosts Morning Joe on MSNBC, and he was a pretty right-wing conservative, congressman from Florida, but he's very into music, he's very into, well, he's into football like me, English football, but more importantly, he's very kind of attractive and funny and a genuinely skillful dude, mm-hmm. you know, extremely mm-hmm. intelligent, likable. Actually, like when he talks to Deepak Chopra, which he does quite a lot these days, it's, you know, there's an intelligent exchange. Danny's point, I think, was that, well, yeah, great, you know, then there'll be all these hip Republicans and people like me, Dave, will say they're great and then they'll get elected and then we'll have a Republican nightmare on our hands. So it's better for them not to be attractive, actually,
uh-huh,
and
right,
to show
yeah.
their true
That's
colors
not, yeah.
so that we'll continue to activate against their cruel policies, if that's what we believe they are.
That's certainly not a cynical remark. That is proper remark, and
it
we
is.
Should be very cautious.
Well, it came out of me saying when I was having lunch with him, Danny, one day, I said, well, you know, did you see Joe Scarborough this morning? He said, yeah, I know you're going to say something good about him. I said, yeah, he was talking about the Beatles, and he was just so knowledgeable about the Beatles. I was really impressed. And Danny's looking at me with this, like, expressionless face and saying, it's more dangerous, David. It's you know, these people will seduce people into thinking they're hip and cool, but where is the compassion?
Yeah. Now, have you been thinking of...
running for office?
No.
Oh,
jumping
okay.
off a cliff, being on the edge of a cliff and kind of looking over. Can you just describe a little of that? I have a panacea for you. Is that the
There's no certainty in any future moment apart from this one. So you might, I'm just going to jump off a cliff, a real sheer one, with tremendously pointed rocks at the bottom, 300 feet down, and then be certain of impalement and instantaneous death. So I'm on the edge all the time.
Isn't
that
nice?
I'm on the edge all the time.
You are. Isn't that nice? Well, here's something for you. I want to play you a song. All right? And this is for Dave, everybody, because we want him to reconsider this. Here you go. Sorry, I always mess up with this thing. Here we go. I'm not going to even tell you what this is till after. Wrong song. I wanted to play that one too, but it was the wrong song. Here it is.
Come to the edge, we said. And they said, no, it's too high. Come to the edge, we said. And they said, no, we're going to fall. And come to the edge, we said. And they very reluctantly came. And we pushed. And they flew.
This is from a movie called One Giant Leap, and there was One Giant Leap was the first movie, and the second, by the same people and with the same theme, was called What About Me? I love that. What About Me? And the song has come to the edge. And, of course, I played this for Dave, and he said, what part of the world's that from? I said, I don't know. I think it's North Africa. And but I don't know. I don't know who the people are, and we're going to have to. We need to put this up on the extras, right? We need to put.
No, we're not. No, we should.
What do you mean, no?
I should go to my iPad right now and check it out.
All right, well, go ahead and check it out. But the gentleman who is behind One Giant Leap, his name is Jamie Cado, and he's from London, England, and. Like I said, they did two different movies. The first one, One Giant Leap, and then What About Me? And it has a lot of different teachers, mostly teachers around consciousness, that are interviewed about various subjects related to What About Me? And interspersed throughout that is incredible footage from around the world, including about, what is it? I think there's 10 different, well, on the CD that's part of this, 10 different songs of, they're kind of mashups of everyone from Western artists through African, Indian.
What's the name of this one? Right?
One Giant Leap. No,
the song, the title.
Come to the Edge, and it's fantastic, folks. And it brings us, of course, this is something you can get on Amazon. I am almost positive, and I can't more highly recommend it, as it's really a real bringing together of music, culture, and consciousness, and it's right. In line with what we're about here at Mind Rolling, and just personally Dave and I, and the kinds of things we love to do. So, and you can go through our portal to get it and help support us. So I just wanted to, that's an offering for you, Dave.
I'm just looking on the track list on all the different things.
Yeah.
There isn't a track called that title. Uh-huh. There are 12 tracks.
Well, you may be on One Giant Leap. This is What About Me? See, that's the difference. Yeah, there's two different films.
Is that a CD too?
I don't know. So you're going to have to put this on the website, or else, you know. Anyhow, moving along. Something we love to do is turn everybody on to some different music, and I have a whole. We've decided that we're going to make at least one offering a week, right, Dave?
Sure. It depends. Could be more, you know, we sometimes just get boring. So as soon as we get boring, put on a piece of music, we can recharge our batteries.
You weren't getting boring just before.
You were
on the edge of throwing yourself off your balcony. So
it's a metaphor, you know. I'm not about to do this, but within my dualistic consciousness, such as it is, sometimes I'm on the edge, on a moment's notice edge, and I don't mean the edge of a cliff, on the edge of some kind of consciousness shift. I'm not like
edge of awakening.
You could call it that. That's a good title for a Ram Dass book.
Yeah,
it comes from one of his speeches.
Talk. We talked about this a few podcasts ago, and it's around death and being with dying people and feeling like in that moment you're on the edge of awakening. And I compared it with being around an enlightened being, and in that same space, the same thing goes on. So it's
we'll find out where that lead singer on the track that we just listened to comes from Jamie or whatever. And let you know, because it's so powerful, that voice. It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
And then the stuff that's going on around it is so atmospherically.
Yeah, no, it's
fabulous.
Incredible. And it's like I say, I think there's a few different artists involved, and they bring it together in a wonderful way.
Yeah, look it up on Amazon, or look it up on Wikipedia to give you the track listing, or on Amazon, and get it from our portal. We're not playing it to advertise it, but you might as well do that if you want to join the club here.
Yes.
So that was great. Wow. Yeah, the music doesn't necessarily relate to what we're talking about. We just want to put music on because it makes the world go round and it's big in
it
our
relates.
Life.
It relates. You were,
it relates,
you know, we were talking about, you know, going in and out of, just David and I on the phone yesterday, going in and out of different moods and being able to have awareness about where we are in that moment and what it is that's going through a dark space or a dark emotion. And we were talking about it, and I did purposefully think in this podcast I wanted to offer, because music to me is the great equalizer. I mean, that is one thing that can really help move your moment along and transform it, right? I mean, you know, the power of that. So I just wanted to make that offering to you, and I had thought about it, and this was a present I wanted to give you. I've been thinking about it for 24 hours. Do you feel appreciative?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do. I just know that I momentarily was spaced out there. It wasn't a hesitation. It was one of those moments, one of those edges that came in between me and the answer to your question. Yeah, I appreciate it. I love it. I'd like to know more about the musicians, because it's so interesting, you know. I mean, music, you're right about music.
All right, well, I'll have it way more together next time for you.
Okay. Well, you know.
Moving on,
yeah. So it's summertime here now, and that's when we're talking on the East Coast.
Did you want to talk about the military-industrial complex?
Well, I was sort of sliding into that kind of, and saying it's just a beautiful
day. I've been avoiding it, you see.
Well, just it's a brief, like, wrap. But
all right, give your rap. You're on a, you know, this is like radio. Do it.
I mean, thousands, if not millions of people on Facebook are constantly bringing up issues which ultimately are the fault, if you like, if there's any, of the military-industrial complex. And they bring up that expression, but it's also, a lot of it is about the use of drones, a lot of it's the use of aggression outside the United States, by the United States, and so on. And it's just always being talked about. But it's interesting that the original, where it came from, was President Eisenhower's farewell speech before John Kennedy became president. In 1961, Eisenhower gave this speech, which was an intense warning against what he called the military-industrial complex and power being shifted to a few people,
really?
And causing the erosion, if not the destruction, of democracy. It's in that speech.
Wow.
How do you know this? Yeah, well, that's why I'm telling you this.
That's why you're here.
So basically, I did some research and found out that when the speech was originally written by a combination of people, including Eisenhower, he talked about it being the military-industrial congressional complex. But they sort of shut that down because... And then there was a group that there were many versions. The military-industrial scientific complex was another one. The military-industrial academic complex was another one. And now I would add the word media to it. Military-industrial media complex. Military-industrial congressional entertainment media complex. Whatever it is that holds the system as fragile as it is in place. But at the expense of the most useful way of making money, which is to keep making arms that keep getting used. And there needs to be refurbishing all the time. So you have this incredibly huge, powerful industry in the United States, Britain, Germany, well, not so much Germany, but certainly France, Israel, South Africa, many countries. Other countries like Brazil have retreated from that position. But the United States has not moved an inch. So basically, the military-industrial, congressional, media, scientific, academic complex is the matrix in which we all have to try and live, whether we like it or not. And thereby lies, you know, there has to be such, I don't know, there has to be some kind of gentle way without war and anger and rioting and craziness to erode this military-industrial complex. That's my speech. And do it via, you know, conscious methods of protest and activism.
Tough situation, anyway, because again, yeah. we talked about, you know, it's the same as in politics. You immediately get into a judging, polarizing mindset.
Well,
as soon as you just said this whole thing to me, all these images came to my head about the reality of it, you know, especially that incredible circular thing that is going on, where there's constant supply of arms, they're being used. They're being replenished, you know, other things are being developed, tons of money being put into developing one system or another. But the huge engine that is out of control. So you have these images and you are immediately polarized by going, these people are absolutely fucked.
Really? I mean, Raghu, I saw the thing on TV a couple of nights ago. One F-15 fighter jet or F-16 or F-22, I don't even matter which one could solve all the educational problems in a city like New York. A couple of $1 billion spent on research and on the plane. If you infused a couple of $1 billion into the city of New York, nobody can tell me you couldn't improve the educational system there. So this is how topsy-turvy it is. It's what the Mayans called the upside-down world.
That's upside-down world.
You know, everything's the wrong way around. You know,
right?
But your issue is very real. It's just, you know, it's crazy, and we know it is crazy. But using the word crazy, sort of, when people say, "Oh, it's so crazy," you sort of automatically feel like they don't want to talk about it. That's why they use the word crazy. What we're talking about right now is how do you maintain equanimity and being here now and being a gentle participant on the planet and fight against a clearly, you know, extremely ugly...
I think those words, though, that you're using, they're so overused and they have no real substance to them anymore.
Fight?
No, no. How do we do this peacefully, gently... You know, all of that.
I think by actions, by, you know, the way people are, in fact, doing them, which is by setting up new subsystems within smaller communities of all kinds of things, from bartering to local gardening to local product to, you know, various forms of microeconomies and smaller banks and, you know, more receptive sort of modules within the society to deal with people's finances and life and the way they live. I don't know. I mean, that's not.
But how do you? Okay, let me just. Yes, certainly. And these things are going on. Definitely groups of people in various neighborhoods around this country that are pooling together and doing the kinds of things that can offset that mentality. But there's something else, like on Facebook. How much of this stuff around Monsanto do you see? I mean,
I see a ton of it. I see at least 10 a day, maybe 20.
So, okay, take one person, and I've seen, you know, individuals who every day, more than once, are talking about the evil Monsanto. Is it Monsanto or Monsanto?
Yeah,
Monsanto. Or, you know, there's some kind of YouTube clip that they're linking to and so on and so forth. Every day, day after day.
Yeah.
There's something obsessive it's the opposite of what they want to happen. So there's something missing.
Well, I don't totally agree with you about that, because you think about it, they're fighting against, like, the GMO thing is the Obama administration has put an ex-GMO guy in charge.
You put something out about this yourself.
Yeah. I did, because all the votes in Congress and at the presidential level have gone in favor of GMOs and not being able to object to them, whereas in many countries in the world, governments have said, no, we're not having it here because we don't trust it, and it can be poisoned and kill people. So if you want to fight that, you've got to propagandize. You've got to use the same propaganda they use. They have Facebook. We have Facebook. So they use it all the time. If they didn't get obsessive about it, they'd just lose. I mean, and they're losing in any case. So
it's the relationship with the, what I'm trying to talk about is not that it shouldn't be done. I think that the frequency in some cases and the kind of vehemence that you see some that people have, anger vehemence, let's talk about this issue because you see this so much, and it is a major issue, and there's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, get the Russians are fighting the Americans, you know, about how can you justify backing Monsanto in the United States, and how can he? So he can't resist this, Obama. Somehow the forces of the corporate the military industrial complex has defeated Obama on this subject and many others, it would seem. But what I'm talking about is the individual who is trying to do something to oppose this kind of thinking and these kind of actions gets so far wrapped up in it, and that angry tirade, which is very similar to the tirade that Monsanto is putting out there, and the lobbyists and so on. There's a similarity between these two expressed emotions, and I just wonder how successful that can be.
I think it's more, Roger, I think it's more complex than that, actually, because from what I look at on Facebook, for instance, there's a great range of different people talking about the GMO thing, and most of them are pretty sober, actually. They're not ranting. They just put the facts on the table, about this, that, and the other, and they usually link to something that's in the New York Times or Washington Post, whatever. They're not ranting. They're just constantly putting in so people won't forget this is an issue. Then there are those others, and typically those are the people who want to say really nasty things about Republicans. Then it really gets like murderous and malign and extremely unattractive. So let's talk about that. I mean, in other words, the Monsanto thing is a real issue, right? And it's not going away because the internet's not going to let it go away. What else have we got? We don't have good representation in the government because the government's bought and sold. So, but you're right. There's no point in getting angry about it. But there has to be a degree of, shall we say, outrage that makes people actually do anything, or should they just let the world go to hell?
There can be tremendous outrage, and there can be a anger, actually, in my mind. But if it can only be done from a place where you are not wanting to actually kill that person.
Absolutely.
I could say it in a more spiritual way, where you're not harming another heart, which is what we have gotten from our lineage. But that is a very difficult thing to do, and it can only be done if you're practicing on yourself to get yourself straight while with the same energy that you're putting out against Monsanto, I think we all have an opportunity if we keep that in mind. And again, that goes back to, we talked about this in that meeting we had yesterday, and it was about the fact of what can we do in terms of social action, where we always have in mind to be able to come from, not from your, from a duality, place of duality, place of ego. Come, and these are, like New Agey terms, or, it's like, Jesus, I can hardly say them, but coming from a compassionate heart has to be part of this equation. And that's why I kind of see, I don't know if I see that all the time. And in other, in another sense, there is such a tremendous, it is so powerful, this military-industrial complex that we are talking about, along with the lobbyists, that unless, it's like you do have to bark pretty loud.
Exactly.
In this particular system, it's about barking at your local representative. And then you get how many people are barking on this, in a way that's going to make any dent. It has to be in numbers. And then you start to think there is another half of us that does not think in that way, does not think there's anything wrong with this GMO, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't know if there's been any polls done or anything, but I am sure that this is, like most other things, this is split right down the line in terms of what people believe. I read an article in the Times, I think it was over the weekend. I don't know when it was, but it's within the last week, and it was about food. It was over the weekend. It was in the Sunday paper, and it was about the mutation of the seeds from ancient times, so that what we are eating now is so devoid of flavonoids and all of the other things that are necessary so that we don't have to take supplements. It was just amazing. Corn has completely been mutated to look and taste sweet. And but the rest of it is just not, you know, what used to be there in maize, you know, in the days, you know, when the American Indians were growing maize, is just absolutely not there. And so much of what we have now. So this has been going on for centuries and centuries, this mutation, you know, as a result of people's desire systems for taste is a major thing, but it's really run by how much produce can we sell that will, you know, not rot, you know, not be bug resistant, et cetera, et cetera. So back to the same situation. That's what this GMO thing is really part of. These farmers, it's far, far easier and more productive for them to use these kind of seed. I mean, they're just, you know, and yeah, that's what...
It is in the United States. In smaller countries, the ones that are not doing it, who've already said, you know, actual legislation has been passed to not do it, are smaller countries in Europe. But I mean, I think there's one, well, let's say there's a bunch of them and they add up. But you're right. I mean, the thing is, we know most of the facts about it, and we know that it sounds bad, and the government should not be sanctioning it. But that's where the military-industrial, you know, yeah, capitalist corporate system comes into place, where agribusiness is more powerful than your local farmer everywhere.
Why haven't you, where is your, you should have a, you are really, you know, you've been putting stuff out on Facebook about this, and you actually helped educate me a little bit with whatever article you connected with. Why aren't you out there with a placard at this point? I'd say you should be down in Manhattan getting some people together.
No,
I mean, you know, no, talk about action. Come on.
No, it will never happen.
Why? And,
because whenever I did anything like that ever, it was a disaster. So, you know,
what, you did that, something like that?
Give well, me you know, protesting in the streets.
When did you protest in the street?
1969.
Where was it?
Washington.
Okay, against?
The Vietnam War.
You went out and protested against the Vietnam War in Washington in 67.
I did it in Cambridge, in Harvard Square, twice. I did it in Berkeley. Well, that was the People's Park Rebellion. I did it about five or six times, actually. And I, you know, don't want to do it again.
Uh-huh.
I think it's good for people to get in the streets, though, because it gets them on television to some extent. You know, I mean, a lot of this stuff, you know, seriously, a lot of this stuff is because the media doesn't cover the real issues. You think about how much of the media is based on individual murders and mass shootings and tornadoes and God knows what. But, I mean, they're not talking about endemic problems in the society that are causing people suffering all the time. And that's the media part of the military-industrial media complex.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you sort of depressed. But the thing is, what is kind of, you know, redemptive to me right now is that just through Facebook and various, you know, people, I see how much people a lot younger than me are literally hip beyond words about the actual issues, you know, and have found ways to make their voice known.
Yeah, you know? that you just hit the old nail right on the head, because it is, and it's what we've talked about before. I think this has been a thread since we've started the Mind Rolling podcast, that the level of interest about changing people's their own insides from the 20s and 30s, we should say, I mean, into 40s, it's not the level of interest, though, especially in the generation, you know, that's that new generation that's there now, to change their insides and at the same time get with people and change what is going on now is, we both said this is at the highest level since, we believe, since the 60s, since the late 60s, when, you know, people really banded together. And of course, you know, that whole era has been put down, but there was, you know, just over the years, it has definitely been negated as to that was just a flower power druggy thing, and then, you know, music, and that was the end of that. But it isn't true, because people that were there then have, many of them, you know, created a bridge, and you know, and we want to do that with mind rolling. I mean, that's definitely what one of our purposes here, and created a bridge to give something to this generation relative to the similar stressors that you can compare from back then to now, and tools that and just, you know, talk about stuff in a way that people can relate with.
Well, yeah, I mean, everybody gets angry about what, you know, even if you just watch TV, you're angry with what's going on. It's like, oh my God, I can't believe these people are just totally useless, you know. Hey.
What?
I hear a hound. You know, but I mean, we go through the conflict because maybe the way we can be a bit of a service about it is we keep insisting that, and it's right, that if you're not coming from really a peaceful heart and a giving heart that won't hurt other hearts no matter what, then your political activism can be actually negative karmically by causing more anger and more upset and disturbing emotions in the body politic or in just the body, actually. So that's a crucial kind of thing that Raghu and I talk about all the time, which is that when I was doing those protests, I wasn't the angriest of the angry, believe you me. But I had a certain kind of rage, and there was a certain kind of excitement about seeing these riot squads coming out. I knew that we're making a difference of some kind. But that's not really where it's at anymore, because now we know that, you know, we're trying to think about these issues in terms of our children, our friends, our children to come, our future incarnations. Do I want to be born into another hellhole? No.
Well, depends what you come back as. That's the question.
Have you thought about that? Yes. I want to come back as something like, Joni Mitchell.
Wow, I sort of envisioned you coming back and being born in Benares, India.
Yeah, that's probably more what I want. But I just wanted to be facetious. But you know, the truth is, you don't know. But really, though, you know, the axis between anger and activism, those two A's, mm-hmm. that comes up time and time again in these podcasts so far, and it's going to come up. And we'd like to hear from you about what you go through about it, or what you feel.
Yeah, I mean,
about
it's a great, great subject, absolutely. And we have been, as you say, talking about it quite a bit. At the same time, one of the big we talk about similar pressures, you know, from when we came up to people are coming up now, meaning, you know, formative years. But we haven't. I guess we did have the thing of the nuclear age, right? The nuclear bomb. That fear that was going to happen and end our existence. Now there's the fear that, you know, the environment cannot support what is going on, and it is already happening. You know, in all over the world, where look at just happened in Oklahoma. That has to be the fiercer storms, the fiercer droughts, the fiercer, you know, monsoons. All of it is the daily indication of this thing has gone amok. And what we are doing to ourselves on this planet. So this is a great subject to continue on in future podcasts. And we should probably get some people on to talk a little bit more about it, because how do you try and be effective as a social activist, yet be able to come from a place that you're not polarized? I mean, it sounds almost impossible, but we'd love to hear from more people. We should talk to Danny about this. I mean, Danny thinks about this kind of stuff, and he's worked in this area. Danny Goldberg, he's worked in this area, God, pretty much his whole life. So, let's talk to Danny about this. And what else? That's it, Dave. I've become tired of your ranting about the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, I'm a bit tired of it myself, actually. But, you know...
I'm just kidding.
It's just... Well, the thing about it is, you know, it's not that people need to know this stuff. People find it out at their own time and everything. But there is sort of a feeling, you know, I think now, that, you know, the only thing that won't polarize people is if they can continue to express themselves about what they think is wrong. That's where the internet comes into it.
Yeah.
So the internet to me is like, it can be like that extended, limb, that or brain power, and it goes
or
out
bridge.
There.
A bridge.
Yeah, exactly. Bridge.
Well,
so, you know.
All right. At this point, did you want to do any more advertisements for our survival here with mind rolling?
Yeah, definitely.
Or have you done enough with that 30
seconds? I'm beginning to enjoy doing these ads because they make you think like nimbly. Go to mindrollingpodcast.com, our website, which we're changing a little now, but it's still pretty good. Go to it. And if you want to buy something from Amazon, there's a portal there, a banner, the bottom part of the page. And if you hit that, it doesn't do anything except make your purchase come up on our data, and we get a small percentage of that, and it keeps the thing going. And it really does. And they're honest, and we get, you know, they send money, whatever. But if you do that, that would really help us. The other thing is audible.com, our affiliate. We're an affiliate there. That's, you know, the spoken word on, you know, that stuff. And
spoken word, that stuff. We have to send this little commercials into Audible, and they have to verify that we're not downgrading their brand.
I broke
that
down.
Ping there. What?
You know, I thought this. There's a banner on our page, Audible. If you want somebody reading something that you like, they've got it on a CD or whatever.
There you go. That's
and
it.
And you have deals, trial months when it's free, and I think it's $2 now, but it's certainly one. And then, you know, if you like the process, you'll get more from them. But we do get money from them, and they're very honorable and easy to deal with people, I might add, because I've dealt with them. They're really nice, and we like them. So do that.
All right, that's it. That's
are we
it.
At the end of this thing now?
We're at the end. We're at the end. And we're going to, as George Burns said, say goodbye, Gracie.